Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. It is Thursday, 26th of November. For Americans like myself, happy Thanksgiving. I'll be taking the day off early to have some turkey later today. But in the meantime, a pretty lackluster session, at least in the U.S., back and forth a little bit. People digesting some more negative U.S. data points. We had the jobless claims out yesterday. Just not where you want them to be at that 750 plus K level. And the Michigan confidence as well, the final figure for November, getting a notch adjusted lower. Just not supportive for the market narrative here. In fact, that jobless claims number, I was trying to dig it up, was 778K. So this is the worst in several weeks. And again, concerns around the fiscal cliff heading into year end and the standoff potentially with the lame duck Trump administration and Congress, where the Republican side is at $500 billion and the Democratic side is at $2+ trillion. That is the near-term concern. Markets largely ignoring that, looking to next year, hoping that maximum support from central banks is going to continue to pave the way higher for equities. As I mentioned yesterday, and we put up a chart, the MSCI Global Equity Index headed for potentially, if we close near current levels, the greatest month in the history of global stock markets. Peter, anything you wanted to add on yesterday's session in particular, and just the narrative here, or what, where the focus is?
Well, we have been in a rotation theme with investors positioning themselves for cyclical stocks and value stocks. We've talked about energy and financials being up a lot, and yesterday we saw a reversal of that trend. It was definitely the growth and technology stocks, momentum stocks, that were gaining relative to the opposite trade, namely the value stocks. And it seems a little bit like we're seeing a continuation of that trend today as well. And I think it was a backdrop of very weak macro numbers coming out of both the US and Europe, maybe jolting the optimism a little bit and basically creating uncertainty on the rebound. My personal view is that we need more stimulus coming from the US and Europe, and right now the US is in limbo, and Europe with their budget also being potentially postponed all the way to early next year because of Poland. Very, very ugly situation but right now the equity market is not paying too much attention to that, or at least technology stocks doesn't really care. But that's another story and something we touched upon yesterday, you know, this very speculative fever. But on slide two, I'm highlighting Japan again. I mean, I wrote this piece the other day on analysis.saxo. I mean, a Japanese equity seeing a new dawn, a question mark. And to a large extent, I think there is a lot of information in this big move we have seen lately. I mean, Japanese equities up more than 15% in just a little bit more than a month, and Japanese stocks, as I said, I mean, increasingly more interesting. They're more profitable, the companies there. They're getting more shareholder friendly, lower financial leverage. If you really think inflation is coming next year, Japanese companies will do much better. But then also you have that pro-cyclical component of Japanese companies into the global economy, and we're still betting on China easing financial conditions next year, and that will have a positive spillover effect into Japan. So watch this index if you really want some action in equities, because that is really where things are flying, except outside technology stocks.
Yeah, another place things are not flying is in the gold market. Although we've looks like 1800, the round level seems to be the focus for garnering some support into this market. Not a lot of price action, I guess, to support a case. What's your view? I know we're of course long-term gold bulls, but any fresh thoughts there?
Well, I think over the last 24 hours, John, we've seen some support starting to come from two of the normal key sources, i.e. the dollar, which has weakened, and also the yield developments in the U.S. On slide 7 today, you can just highlighting the U.S. 10-year area where you at the top you got the break evens, which looks like they are trying to break to the upside, i.e. Pricing in higher inflation expectations, and at the same time the real yields at the bottom is testing the uptrend since early September. So if that trend continues, then I think we've seen a low in gold, but and silver for that matter. Gold 1800 was a 200-day moving average. You can almost argue it's almost too simple if that's going to be enough to arrest the slide, but so far it has. And in silver, 2290 is the key level of support to look out for there. So for now, if we do continue to see these movements continue in the dollar and in the yields, then I think we've seen a low. But we need to get back above 1850 before we're back on safer grounds. So still a lot of ground to cover before we can start talking about this correction being behind us. So for the meantime, the key focus this week in metals has been the industrial kind of those with an industrial use, especially copper, which has raced to the highest since January 14, and the platinum as well, which is up at a 2 months high at this stage.
All right, and I talked to you yesterday a little bit about the U.S. yield curve. And the steepening and sort of the missing piece here, if we're supposed to be seeing a more inflationary narrative. I mean, you have to imagine that long yields need to head higher if we are looking forward to a more inflationary situation, unless you believe that there's no point in speculating in that direction because those yields will be capped eventually by the Fed. And there was a little bit of hints of that as a policy option in the FOMC minutes last night. There were talks about how the Fed could change policy to support the market. And one of those mentions was in longer term yields. So it didn't sound like there was any sense of urgency at all linked to recent moves in the yield curve. It does seem clear that they want to do something in changing their guidance at the December meeting, but it's not entirely clear what. And there were actually a couple of dissenting voices on the Fed in which a few members expressed concern on their MBS buying, quote, potentially driving valuation pressures in the housing market. So that was an interesting note there that some are a bit uncomfortable with maybe the speculation with financial conditions becoming so generous that it creates risks in certain pockets of the market. But not a huge takeaway there. But on slide three, you can see where the 5 to 30-year slope is. That's the black line. And then the 2s to 10s, which is the typical yield curve slope metric in the blue. But I think the 5 to 30 actually often does a pretty good job of leading. And we saw that it turned higher already sort of a bit more clearly in late 2018 and began headed and sort of led the eventual turn in the 2s, 10s. Likewise, it recently topped out and sort of headed lower before the 2s, 10s did. So besides the explicit yield levels, we look at the yield curve to see what's going on. And, you know, working against that narrative, the market could be very happy that the yield curve isn't steepening because lower long yields means the multiple argument is still in place for speculative stocks. It means, okay, the fiscal ability of fiscal stimulus to come to the table is in doubt, but with maximum central bank pressure to support the market, it allows risk assets to do just fine. Thank you very much. One risk asset not doing fine is Bitcoin and some of the others in the crypto space. When I snapped the chart on slide four, it was down, I think, around $1,000 from yesterday's close, just below $18,000. It's down below $17,300 as we're talking now. $1,500 almost, let's call it 8%, 8.3% down on the day. Maybe an article I tweeted out earlier from Coinbase, in which the CEO of that cryptocurrency exchange flagged concerns that the U.S. Treasury market is set to make it a bit onerous to collect data on those.
They were talking about this to be a store of value, if I remember correctly, right? And store of value, of course, changes 15% overnight.
Yeah, it's I detect a tiny bit of cynicism in your voice there, Peter. And it just goes to show that this is a gangster market. I think is the safe thing to say. And there are, of course, very sober and interesting reasons to be long cryptocurrencies and to find the space interesting and, you know, leave it to investment legends like Druckenmiller and Paul Tudor Jones to discuss the space. And they have exposure in the market as well. So, you know, we're not, but yes, the volatility is tremendous, but the specific story perhaps driving this volatility could be this fear that regulation is about to put its heavy hand into the market. It doesn't necessarily have to remove those arguments in favor of crypto, but it makes it a bit more onerous for the whole for the whole situation, especially for those that are using the cryptos for tax avoidance or for illegal activities, which are already there are some limitations around it, that KYC and know your customer, etc. So anyway, just wanted to flag that story as a possible driver. And then very briefly on the dollar outlook, if the dollar is supposed to be a flip side of risk sentiment, it's not very impressive how little the dollar has weakened relative to what it looks like is going to be a spectacular month for global equities. Euro dollar, you can see it. It was poking above that highest day to close around 119.35. And now it's back below as I'm speaking here. 120 is really the cycle key. And then other currencies, and we're seeing almost across the board, there are a number of key dollar levels, support levels that are either going to stand or fall here in unison. And that will be interesting to see if that does finally spark some more interest in speculating against the dollar from the point of view that U.S. deficits are driving the dollar lower and people don't want to snap up U.S. debt given the risk of highly negative real yields. And you can see dollar Canada in the 130 level on slide six, and the 129.50-60 area is the actual major low from a prior episode earlier in 2020. Yeah, so next, you talked about copper, you talked about gold, Ole, and oil is there as a, you know, it's been rising to new highs lately. Does that feed into this slide you're talking about here, Peter? It's not really the energy cost so much, but of course, if energy did rise, it would only add to this a bit. You came up with an interesting look at how last mile costs are rising for delivery companies that are needing to deliver, and I assume that has been related to this crush of interest in buying online that unfolded over the pandemic.
I think it's courtesy of our CIO, Steen Jacobsen. He flagged this internally, but I think also he tweeted it out yesterday. So it's Bloomberg that was running this story that FedEx and UPS is seeing a huge shortage of vans and drivers. And it's all driven by this e-commerce rush. So there's two things. So if you look at slide nine, you can see the price chart of FedEx. It's just, you know, it's up almost 200% from the, it is up 200% from the absolute lows in March. If you're looking at the dreary Hong Kong, Los Angeles container rate benchmark rate for a 40-foot box container, we're up from around $1,500 in March to around almost $4,000 as we speak right now. It's the highest price in almost in more than a decade. It's probably the highest price in 2 decades. I can't see prices in Bloomberg going back further than 2011, but this is a very steep acceleration. So, and it fits with the comments we have got from all these logistics firms, including Maersk, the biggest shipping company, last week or 2 weeks ago when they came with their earnings, saying that there's a lot of bargain power from shipping and logistic companies because of this massive ramp up in e-commerce, which creates a huge push on logistics. And the thing is that if you look at the small insert we have on the slide, you can see this is from a book on global supply chains. You can see on a $150 apparel piece, you can see that free shipping, returns, and warehousing is around 10% of the cost structure of an e-commerce company. And they're generally running more fat margins. So there is room but for this these costs to go higher. But I'm not sure if you look at the current e-commerce prices that that the equity market is truly reflecting what's going on the ground in terms of cost, and this could potentially be a hiccup for a lot of e-commerce companies in the quarters to come. It's definitely something to watch. We'll flag it and we'll talk more about it on analysis.saxo today in a piece. And just a small info which I thought was pretty interesting. So look at this from Supply Chain Dive. I mean, Amazon lost $7.2 billion last year from shipping. So that's the difference between Amazon's shipping cost and what they charge for it. And so they see it as a service to their customers, but it's actually a pretty big expense. And what's even more interesting about Amazon and this cost is that if Amazon didn't have the Amazon Web Services, their cloud infrastructure, where they, by the way, if we've talked about, is losing ground now to companies like Snowflake and Google and Microsoft. If they didn't have the Amazon Web Services, I'm not sure they could cross-subsidize this huge cost on shipping. So potential interesting times ahead for a company like Amazon. And I guess also this is the reason why they have made this vertical integration into logistics. They're trying to see if they can push down costs by themselves by being smarter. I'm not sure necessarily that they will succeed in that. I think sometimes you just need to get things from third parties where you have competition instead of trying to do everything else, everything yourself vertically.
Yeah, and not completely related to what you're talking about, but can I just put it out there? I think Snowflake needs to consider changing the name of its company. I think it's the worst named company that I've come across in recent market history. Let's go to your next slide. You're looking at Salesforce and this rumor that it's looking into acquiring Slack.
Yeah, so that was a big story yesterday. It was done by Dow Jones. They have apparently talked to a source inside these negotiations, and expectations are that already by next week, Salesforce will announce a potential acquisition of Slack. But it depends whether they can agree on it. The valuation number that has been put out there is $17 billion for Slack. But that, I mean, if you look at the yesterday's closing price, that puts the market value of Slack at around 22.5 on an enterprise value, as you can see on that insert on slide 10. And I think it's an interesting story for two reasons. So Salesforce, if they do this acquisition, it's the biggest acquisition they've ever done in their 21-year history. It will add around 5% top line growth by 2022 based on the current estimates for Slack's revenue. But look at the insert. I mean, we're talking about a company, Slack, that is generating zero free cash flow. They barely positive cash flow positive on the operation side, and Salesforce is willing to pay $17 billion or maybe 20 or 22, depending on whether they actually accept the market price. I think Slack has been really one of those very disappointing stocks, as you can see as well. We have the price chart next to the inserts, and it's just it was last day's price action actually that for the first time took Slack above its IPO price. It's really one of those failed IPOs, I would say, and it really hasn't really mustered a lot of attraction and attention from investors.
But isn't it all this? Folding into all this platform argument that it's not about what the standalone company Slack generates by itself, how useful it is as a component. Just like when Facebook acquired WhatsApp for some absurd price, it has nothing to do with what the actual.
Totally. Yeah. I I'm probably very cynical, but I mean, if you take a technology like Slack and you morph it into the Salesforce platform, and you take Salesforce distribution, I'm pretty sure, and that's what they're looking at, they could maybe lay off half of all Slack's employees, and it wouldn't make a change. You don't need all that infrastructure because you already have that in Salesforce. And the final point is that if this acquisition goes through, it's just another sign of the monopoly forces still in play in US technology. You have the big five, Google, Facebook, Microsoft, Amazon, and Apple, that are all quasi monopolies in their own right. And I think Salesforce is now joining this gang of five to be the sixth quasi monopoly, gobbling up all these infrastructure software players. In the end, it's bad for competition, but that's another day's discussion about antitrust. And we can only hope from an economics point of view, and not from a shareholder point of view, but from an economics point of view, that the US government will soon get its act together on antitrust, because it's just another sign that it's not going the right way, if you ask me.
By the way, when you mentioned the antitrust, I sent out a tweet yesterday, and I'm forgetting all of the contents of it, but there are signs, and the, one of the interesting things about it was that this antitrust business is a bipartisan issue, and the potential leader of the antitrust, whatever the committee is in the House that represents this team, could prove to be a Colorado Republican, and this is very interesting. It's something I think if you have a sufficient number of Republicans willing to work on this issue, look out next year. This is a big issue potentially for all of these big, like you say, all these big monopoly platforms. One market we need to discuss here before closing out the podcast is oil. I just pulled up Ola. I just pulled up a curve chart of where the crude oil is now versus where it was a month ago. So when we were still in the dark about this Pfizer and other news on vaccine candidates, and what a remarkable shift you're seeing, where you're seeing the far flatter curve. And to me, a bit odd that even the front months have so aggressively rallied together, even in the coming months. And I had a sense in the internal call that you were a bit uncomfortable with maybe the very front of the curve being as aggressively bid as it is, but tell me if I'm wrong.
I agree, John, and as we talked about earlier, this November 9 is really going to go down this year as a key date for many commodities. Those depending on growth and demand, crude oil, energy, and industrial metals, they have seen a quite a significant rally since that date. As obviously as we highlighted, the gold and silver has fallen off or run into a correction. But you're absolutely right. There's no doubt that the outlook for 21 has improved dramatically with the vaccine news, and we also seen that reflect in stock market. The XLE, which is reflecting the performance of U.S. Energy companies, is up 45% since the recent low in October. We did see a first sign of correction yesterday ahead of the Thanksgiving break. But looking at the crude oil chart, especially Brent crude here on slide 8, you can see we are approaching some key psychological resistance here around the 50 level. And ahead of next week's crucial OPEC Plus meeting starting on Monday, I really don't see any reason why one would wade into Brent at these levels, considering the potential risk of OPEC Plus struggling to reach an agreement. What is absolutely paramount important is that they agree to cancel the original plan to increase production and keep the current levels for another 3 months, because we need to get well into 21 before the actual demand the recovery is going to come from these vaccine news. So at this moment, the price is potentially driven to levels where they potentially in the short term could be a little bit difficult to sustain. But 21 is obviously looking a lot brighter than it did just a few weeks ago.
Yeah, and then just on a forward curve argument, noticing that the curve is so flat. And so even to me, if I'm a longer term investor looking at it, late October or late 2022 barrels selling at the same price as the spot barrel seems like a decent deal to me to look at that rather than the front month. But of course, it'll be far less volatile, I would assume.
Indeed, yeah.
I will retweet that article that I tweeted out yesterday on the market call at Saxo Market Call Twitter account. So look for that as well. If you have any questions or comments, we do have an email address. We don't often flag it, but we should. marketcall@saxobank.com. Please, if you have any questions or feedback on the show, we'd be happy to hear from you. And you can contact us there. You can also leave a review for us under Apple Podcasts. That helps us with distribution and getting awareness of the podcast, which we need, of course, to continue to do to be able to continue to deliver the content. Very briefly on the calendar highlights for today, we have the Thanksgiving holiday totally shut in the U.S., only half a day of trading tomorrow in equities, at least in the U.S. A Riksbank meeting, nobody's expecting anything from them except zero rates and eventually bumping up QE. And we have the minutes of the ECB meeting. I think maybe a little bit interesting there to see any signs of the degree of discord. But as Peter pointed out earlier, it really is for Europe about the path towards a more steady fiscal hand to help with the recovery more than the ECB purchases, whether they will be forthcoming. So that's more the focus, I think, for Europe. For now, we will call it a day, and I won't be back tomorrow because I'm taking a holiday, but the team will be back tomorrow with the Saxo Market Call for today. Thanks for joining.